From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, British novelist Zadie Smith. Her novel On Beauty is out now in paperback. It explores racial identity and the culture wars through the lives of two rival university professors and their families. Smith's first novel was the award-winning bestseller White Teeth. Also, Little Children is the new film based on the satirical novel about parenthood in suburbia by Tom Perata. We'll talk with Perata about his novel. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new Stephen Frears film, The Queen. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. On Beauty is Zadie Smith's third novel. Her first, the award-winning bestseller White Teeth, was published in 2000 when she was 25. On Beauty explores the culture wars of the 21st century by reducing that battle to two academics on opposite sides. One's a white liberal, the other a black conservative. Terry spoke with Zadie Smith when her novel was published last year. It's now out in paperback. On Beauty is set in a fictional New England college town and follows the parallel stories of two families. Howard Belsey is a radical arts theorist. He's white. His wife is African American. Newly arrived from England to teach at the same college as a rival professor is Monty Kipps, a black Christian cultural conservative. They have a shared history. Howard's son Jerome once lived with the Kipps family while doing research in England. Now that the Kipps family has come to New England, Jerome Belsey finds he's enjoying spending time with them again and finds them a relief from his own family. Here's Zadie Smith reading from her novel.
How could he explain how pleasurable it had truly been to give himself up to the Kippses? It was a kind of blissful unselfing, a summer of un-Belsey. He'd allowed the Kippses' world and their ways to take him over entirely. He'd liked to listen to the exotic, to a Belsey, chatter of business and money and practical politics, to hear that equality was a myth and multiculturalism a fatuous dream. He thrilled at the suggestion that art was a gift from God, blessing only a handful of masters, and most literature merely a veil for poorly reasoned, left-wing ideologies. He'd put up a weak show of fighting these ideas, but only so that he might enjoy all the more the sensation of the family's ridicule, to hear once again how typically liberal, academic, and wishy-washy were his own thoughts. When Monty suggested that minority groups too often demand equal rights they haven't earned, Jerome had allowed this strange new idea to penetrate him without complaint and sunk further back into the receiving sofa. When Michael argued that being black was not an identity but an accidental matter of pigment, Jerome had not given a traditionally hysterical Belsey answer, try telling that to the Klansman coming at you with a burning cross, but rather vowed to think less of his identity in the future. One by one, the gods of the Belseys toppled. "I'm so full of liberal crap," Jerome had thought happily, bowed his head low, and pressed his knees into one of the little red cushions provided for kneeling in the Kipps' pew of the local church.
That's Zadie Smith reading from her new novel On Beauty. Zadie Smith, welcome to Fresh Air. The two main families in your novel are the Belseys and the Kipps. Would you describe some of the defining characteristics you've given to each family?
I think they're quite similar in their way. I mean, the obvious difference is that one family are kind of liberal intellectual Democrats and the other family are, he's actually a Trinidadian with a very kind of colonial mindset, a black Englishman with very conservative views. But what I was more interested in is the idea that both families have created a little pathology of their own. They're very sure about the kind of people they are. And that's what interested me, that families perform themselves in a certain way to other people, and both families do that.
You perform themselves. You say, like, one of your characters says, married couples are like a vaudeville act.
I do feel that sometimes, and since I got married, I'm much more likely to be invited to the kind of dinner parties where it's nothing but married people, so eight couples. And you do feel that it's kind of a team situation. Each couple is their own team, and there's competitive attitudes between couples, and they come with a performance, with a shtick sometimes. Sometimes a happy shtick, we're so in love, and sometimes quite the opposite type of shtick. We've been married 30 years and we hate each other. But I was interested by that, because when I was single, I thought it was so insane, and now that I'm married, I see how it happens.
The Belsey family in your novel it's a multicultural family. Howard, the father, is a professor. He's a white man from England. Kiki, the mother, is a nurse. She's African-American. What's it like for her in the predominantly white community that the family lives in? And what are some of the things she feels she's maybe given up to be with her husband?
Yeah, I mean, Kiki's one of my favourite characters in the book, and it's exactly because of that, because she loves her husband, but she made a sacrifice to be with him. In the first place, she's not part of the intellectual community that he's part of, and she has to spend a lot of her time, you know, pretending to be interested in things she's not that interested in, having conversations that, it's not because she's stupid, but she just, it's not her milieu, and her milieu is something quite different, and she feels she has no place to express that. And also, I think in one point in an argument, she gets very angry and she does say that she's lost in this sea of white. And I do feel that sometimes that when there's a dominant community in numbers like the white community is in the Western world, they don't tend to imagine that it feels strange sometimes. Like, I go to parties all the time. I have done ever since I was in college, where I'm the only black person. I mean, that's just a standard experience. And for a long time, I stopped noticing it, because after a while, you stop noticing it. And then just every now and then, you look around and it feels strange. And I think for a lot of white people, they can't imagine spending every single day at parties, at meetings, in every work environment with nothing but black people. In courtrooms, if everybody was black and you were the only white guy, it's a strange experience.
Well, you know, and you write about this too through the character of Levi, who's the youngest son. He's the youngest of three children in the family. He's in high school. And he thinks his white father doesn't understand what it's like for the son to be a person of color. He thinks his father doesn't understand that newcomers in the neighborhood see the son and are afraid he's going to rob them. And Howard, the father, dislikes and fears conversations with his son about race. It just makes him really uncomfortable. Go ahead.
That's a sad thing. That's true. I think I thought of my father a little bit like that. It was very much his intention when we were growing up to be colorblind. That was a very popular phrase in the early 80s as well. And it was absolutely well meant and a wonderful way to grow up. But it's okay within the household. But when you walk outside of the house, there are people who aren't colorblind or don't think that way. And I certainly think for both my brothers, with having a father who was not only white, but, you know, 30 years older than he kind of should have been. But that's a very strange experience. It's quite hard to explain how strange it is to be the 15-year-old black son of a 75-year-old white man. So I think I use some of that in the book, definitely.
So your father's white and your mother is black?
Yeah, exactly the same.
Oh, I think it must be so interesting isn't exactly the word I'm looking for, but... must be so something to grow up in a family of different races where your father is a different color than you are. And in the way that race impacts on your life, it's impacted differently on his life than on yours.
I think the one thing that, if I try and promote any idea in my fiction, I hope I don't promote anything too much, but one of them is that when you grow up in such a situation, it's completely normal to you. To me, when I was a child, all families were mixed race, and I found going into households where everyone was white or everyone was black unnerving, because it wasn't what I knew. And also, just as a matter of fact, in my neighborhood, being mixed race was very, very common. So I felt like I was part of a very large community of brown girls. They were everywhere. But I try and show in the book that this experience isn't abnormal at all or in any way different, until sometimes people make you feel that it is, people outside your family circle. I think maybe that's what's happened to Levi.
Describe your neighborhood a little bit, too, the neighborhood you grew up in, where you said most of the families were of, mixed race.
Yeah, traditionally it's an Irish area and a black area. It's called Kilburn. It has an enormous amount of Irishmen and Jamaicans, and that's kind of reflected in my family. Almost all the women in my family end up marrying Irishmen, and I did as well. And the neighbourhood is just very, very mixed. My brother teaches in a school in the next street to where I live, and next street to where we were all born. And in his school, there's something like 104 languages spoken. So that's the kind of environment it is. It's just like the whole world on your doorstep.
One of the sons in the Belzy family in your book speaks very differently than his parents do. And again, his mother is black, his father is white. But but the son speaks a much more, and this is Levi, speaks a much more hip-hop kind of language. And he wants to sound more street. And his parents just can't figure out, where did this come from?
I think it's quite common, that kind of difference within family. It can be class, it can be a matter of vocabulary, it can be an obsession. Like, I was in a bookstore quite recently, and the owner was telling me that his daughter is obsessed with 50s rockabilly culture, and it's like having a completely different person in the house. And I think that particularly teenagers, when they're intent on making themselves, often choose things which are completely outside the family circle. And my youngest brother was like that. He became very obsessed with Indonesia and Islam, for example. So we're a kind of black English family with no religion, and our youngest brother was an Indonesian fascinated Muslim boy. So that stuff happens all the time.
Well, the character in your novel, the son that we're talking about who wants to be more street, he falls in with some young men from Jamaica who he thinks are real cool, are really cool because, you know, they're street hustlers and they're poor, they seem more authentic to him. And I wonder, you know, in America, I think there is this kind of fascination with, quote, authenticity. And for a lot of people, you know what I mean? Like being more street seems more authentic. And being middle class and educated seems less authentic. Is there a similar dynamic in England? Is this like an American thing?
It's all over the world. But the idea is, I think sometimes people sneer at it, particularly in rap music, the idea of authenticity or being real. But that's kind of almost an existential hope, and it follows in poetry, it follows in academic life. There's always a quality called authenticity which people are seeking. And I don't know why, you know, it's often ridiculed in rap music when, and I try to show this in the book, it's just as common on a university campus. Howard also wants to be authentic, and his idea of authenticity is to be as purely theoretical as possible. So Levi also has the urge for authenticity. I think it's very common, and particularly when people are moving between classes, and I guess that's true of my family, that we're not working class anymore. You're very glad to be middle class, but you also have a slight, I don't know, nostalgia about what it was to be working class. And there's equivalence, say, in poetry, the idea of the pastoral, of being back at in the country. That's an idea of authenticity, to be part of the land rather than part of the city. I think it's a really common human instinct.
What did authentic mean to you when you were growing up?
Well, I was different from, say, my little brother in that I was very, very determined to be... I wanted to be educated, and I thought that was the most important thing. And I wasn't too concerned about what I might lose on the way to being educated. And it was only once I became educated that I realised that I wasn't the person I'd been before. And my voice has changed, my habits have changed, my tastes changed, you know, I eat in restaurants, I travel in cabs, my whole life has changed. And sometimes I suppose I do feel nostalgic for a different life or a life that I came from, and sometimes I put that in my fiction. But I don't know, I was never as obsessed with authenticity in that way. In fact, I had much more my parents' habit of wanting to transform into something else. I was quite hopeful for that.
Zadie Smith, speaking to Terry Gross 1 year ago. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with Zadie Smith, author of the best-selling novel On Beauty. It's out now in paperback.
One of the characters in your novel is a rapper who is very smart but not very educated. And he wouldn't have the money or the grades or the schooling to go to the university where the novel is set. However, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poetry teacher in the novel recognizes his talent and invites him into the class. And some of the novel is set at this bar where there's a lot of, you know, like spoken word and rap
right.
performances. And you consequently had to write a not very good rap for a not very talented performer to give. And I would love for you to read that for us or perform it for us.
Okay, but I'm not doing the voice. I'm going to do it in my voice.
that's fine.
Okay. My womb, she said, is the tomb, she said, of your previous misconceptions. I know the identity of your serenity. When you claim my hero was blonde, Cleopatra, brother, that's plain wrong. I hear the Nubian spirit behind the whitewash. Oh, gosh, my redemption has its own intention.
How did you write something that you intended to not be good?
And
I should say here, it's not like you don't like rap. You just wanted to write.
No, I love rap.
Yeah.
I guess I this is not quite rap. This is more spoken word. And I do.
Okay,
there's a lot
yeah.
of spoken word I do like. But I recently went to a bar not unlike this in London. And the one thing which struck me about spoken word when it's bad is that it's insanely egotistical. And it's all about this first person voice, and it's relentless. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't end unless you just completely don't clap and turn the other way. And even then it doesn't end. It goes on and on and on. And I've always been interested in that kind of first person voice art. And hip hop, I think, is incredibly creative with the first person, but it's still very different from what I do, which is third person involves lots of different voices and trying to kind of, as best as you can, suppress your own voice. So I'm always amazed by that first person confidence. It's like someone standing on the stage, really confident that everything they say is completely fascinating. And I think that can get a bit tiresome, which is why when hip hop is fantastic, it's amazing, because one man has convinced you that he has the whole world in his mouth. And when it's done brilliantly, I don't think there's anything I like more. But the bad stuff is very bad, that's true.
My favorite rhyme you wrote for the book, and a character who's mocking how bad some of the spoken word is, such as the one we just heard, offers this as an example of how bad it can get. "My vagina in Carolina is much finer than yours."
Yeah, that's horrible.
That's really horrible.
I guess I like art which is really generous, and the book is full of kind of paeans to people like Mozart, like Rembrandt, who try to include as much as possible in their art, and were interested in other people. And I'm quite unnerved by the idea that, and you meet a lot of young writers particularly who say, you know, ask me something like, how will I know when I found my voice? Or, you know, I write a lot of journals but I haven't found my voice yet. And I always think you need to concentrate less on the idea of your voice and maybe listen to more of what's going on in the world and other people.
Let's get back to the character of Kiki, who you've said is, I think, your favorite character in the book. And she's the mother of the liberal family that teaches at the Ivy League University. And again, she's black. Her husband's white. She's put on about 100 pounds during the years of her marriage. Yes. And she's been physically transformed. And it seems as if being physically transformed has changed her personality, too. You describe her as having a spellbinding bosom. And you write, yeah, the size was sexual and at the same time more than sexual. And so her chest gave off a mass of signals beyond her direct control. Sassy, sisterly, predatory, motherly, threatening, comforting. She could no longer be meek or shy. Her body had directed her to a new personality. Would you talk a little bit more about your sense of how a physical change like the one she had changes her personality, and also how race figures, if at all, into what people project onto her as a large woman?
Well, I mean, I think it's always there all the time in terms of your physical presentation. You can't control it. Your face speaks before you. But when you've had a transition, it's much more obvious, you notice it more. And personally, I used to be very big, so I know the difference and I remember it. And I do think that if you're black and big, people would always call me sister and stuff. I got a lot of that. And there's a lot of idea that I would immediately be very humorous, for instance, or very nurturing, and I don't know if I'm either of those things. And then when I lost weight, there's a whole new kind of thing comes into play, and a whole new kind of stereotypical idea of you, which is also not you. And I suppose when I get big again, inevitably, as everyone in my family does, I'll be returned to the previous mode. But I guess when I was a kid and a big kid, I was incredibly aggravated by the idea that something that I considered beyond my control spoke for me. And I had various ideas as a 14-year-old girl about what it would be like to be thin. And then when I became thin, I found all those things were true. And I was even more infuriated that people are nicer to you, that you do get more attention. And that disgusted me even more. So I think a lot of that was put into Kiki, the sense that your face speaks for you and that it sometimes says things that you don't want it to say.
Can you talk a little bit more about the differences in the way you think people saw you when you were heavy and then when you lost weight?
My mother was a model, so she was very, very beautiful when I was very, very big. And I always, part of being big is to be invisible a lot of the time. But then again, I was always quite grateful for my invisibility because I got lots of reading done, for example. I got a lot of work done. And another character in the book, Victoria, who was extremely beautiful, you know, age 17, I think that's a scary place to be. You don't even have time to become a person because the person you are is already projected onto you every day. So I'm glad I was the person I was when I was a kid, because I had my own world and nobody bothered me. I like that about it.
You know, a lot of articles about you comment on how beautiful you are, about your cheekbones, and, you know, having felt that you were heavy before losing weight. How do you feel about when people single out your looks for praise when they're writing about you as a writer?
I know you're meant to be complimented, but every woman knows it's a diminishment. It's a deliberate diminishment. It always has been, and it always will be. If you're a model, that's a different thing. It's your business, and the discussion of your beauty is a daily matter. And that seems to me a kind of a nightmare, but obviously people want to do it and want to be models, and that's fine. But for the rest of us who work in different industries which don't rely on our face, to be reminded of your face is kind of a pain. On the other hand, my mother always says, you know, it doesn't last very long, so just be happy while you have it. But in the context of work, you know, I do find it insulting, and it's depressing to read, as I read several times when I was first published, that I was only published because my manuscript was sent with a photo of myself. Now, nobody says that about men, no matter how pretty they are, and there's a lot of pretty male writers, and I don't think that's meant as a compliment. I think it's meant to suggest that I don't have any ability, or what ability I have has been boosted by my face. So in a way, I hope and I will on my enormous weight gain and age, because when I'm 65, the question will be, is the book any good? Did she write a good book? And that's all that has ever mattered to me.
Zadie Smith, speaking with Terry Gross last year. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of The Other Side of the Bridge, a story of sibling rivalry and misguided intentions by Mary Lawson, author of Crow Lake. From Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. And from Universal Pictures, presenting Robin Williams in Man of the Year, from Barry Levinson, director of Good Morning Vietnam and Rain Man, now in theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with novelist Zadie Smith. Also, parenthood, suburbia, and the feeling you're living the wrong life. Tom Perotta talks about his novel Little Children, which is the basis for a new film. And David Edelstein reviews the new movie The Queen by Stephen Frears. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's return to Terry's interview with Zadie Smith. Her best-selling novel, On Beauty, is out in paperback. On Beauty reflects on the culture wars by following the families of a liberal and a conservative professor. The liberal professor is white, his wife is black, and their three children respond differently to their own racial identities. Smith is the child of a black mother and white father. She grew up in London.
You know, early in your novel, when one of the sons, Jerome, is staying in England, and he's the son in the liberal family, but he's staying with a conservative and Christian family in England. And this family is black, and the father is from Trinidad. So the attitude in that family is that being black is not an identity. It's just an accidental matter of pigment. Where in that, where did you fit in thinking about your racial identity in that scale, somewhere between just a matter, accidental matter of pigment to an identity?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I think of myself as black and English without any ambiguity and as a simple fact. But I'm not sure that I understand the concept, for instance, of being black and proud. I'm not proud of things that I didn't do. I think the idea of being connected to people you don't know and have never met by this one thing is strange. But I also think that identities are chosen and fought after. And I have an interest in black culture and I have an interest in English culture. And I'm black and English to that extent. But I get kind of like people who claim themselves to be nationalist or incredibly English. These are the kind of people who normally haven't read Henry V, for example. So I never claim anything unless I've pursued it. And I've pursued an interest in black culture, so I feel black to that extent, and I've pursued an interest in English culture, so those two things are part of me. But if I just sat around being black and English, I don't know if I would call that an identity.
You said you've pursued an interest in English culture, and I'm sure part of what you're talking about there is English literature. And your book is very much inspired by the writings of E.M. Forster, most specifically Howard's End. In your life as a reader, how have you balanced your interests in more classic fiction with contemporary fiction?
Well, my first love is, I guess, dead people. That's true. They're the first people I read. And for a long time, my education was very traditional. But I fit in contemporary fiction and I enjoy an enormous amount of it. I find it very intimidating because a lot of it is very good. And I guess they're my peers. And it's scary when your peers are that good. But a few writers I've read in the past 10 years have joined the ranks of my most favorite writers. And that I think that's wonderful when that happens.
Your novel on beauty is largely set in a university town. And much of it is set actually on the campus. And looking at the marriages in this university community, for the most part, they are not doing very well.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons. And there's also, you know, affairs between, teachers and students. And I think, you know, this is not the first novel that has affairs between teachers and students. You've been at universities in the States and in England. And I'm wondering, how much of that have you actually seen?
You know, I really didn't mean to suggest that academics are any worse in a marital sense than anybody else. It was much more my fear, because I was just about to get married as I started this book. And because of what I do for a living, a lot of my friends are, you know, 25 to 30 years older than me. And you can't help but notice that a lot of people, either their marriage has fallen apart or they've been divorced twice, and getting married seemed to be a kind of insane act, given the context, when you can't even find one couple still married. So I think writing the book for me was kind of a writing through of that fear. And also the thing that I guess I learned as a young adult, which I didn't realize when I was a kid, because my parents were working class and uneducated, they got divorced very young. And I thought, you know, if only they'd had more education or been more sophisticated, maybe they would have had a happier marriage. I guess I was thinking of the Cosbys or something. And then as you get older, it becomes obvious that it makes no difference what kind of class you are, what kind of person you are. And often the more sophisticated you are, the more horribly complex and emotionally disastrous the divorce can be. So that was a shock for me, because I always thought that the whole point of me becoming, you know, posher was that my life would become easier. And it's not true.
Right. So you were pretty young when your parents divorced?
I was 11, 12. Yeah. I mean, I'm the oldest child, so my brothers were quite a bit younger when it happened. But yeah, I was 11.
Did you stay with one parent or the other?
I stayed with my mother, but because there wasn't enough money to have a proper divorce, my father just stayed in the house for a long time.
You're kidding.
He lived in the spare room. My mother lived upstairs, and they weren't married, but we were still a family. And actually, that's very true to our experience still. Like, even though with a 30-year age gap, even with a divorce that's been done for whatever it is now, 15 years or longer, like, my mother texted me on my phone a few days ago to remind me it was my father's birthday. There's not There's not a great deal of animosity left. There's nothing to fight over anymore, I think.
Was that awkward for you as a daughter to have your parents divorced but living in the same house?
It was strange. You'd have to knock on my father's door to tell him when it was dinner. It was pretty surreal, really. But then again, it didn't seem to be... What was the other option? You couldn't like move into a country house. So we had to deal with the reality. It was strange, but both my parents had a... They're very realistic about family, and they always said family's not something you can escape. Divorce doesn't get you out of family. Just as me being married doesn't get me out of my original family. It's for life. It's a prison sentence, and you just have to deal with it. And I think we've always been quite good at that.
You know, as a novelist, I'm sure you want admission. You want a ticket to seats where you can observe different classes, different races, different religions, different genders, so that you can write about all of that convincingly. Do you feel that your background has helped give you such a ticket?
I think there's a few accidents of my birth, not just my family, but even more so in my school, which is a kind of, you know, a normal public school with an incredible mix of people in it who were both streetwise. They're just savvy. And whenever I meet kids from my school, I know that if they went to Buckingham Palace, they would get on as well as if they went down to the streets of Brixton. They have a way of talking to people. And I think that's true of a lot of people who went to my school. And I noticed about them, they're not stuck in their class. And for instance, when I went to Cambridge and you meet a kid from Eton, they're lovely kids, but they have no way of communicating other than the one that they were given at Eton. And they find it tough. They have to make a leap. And in my school, there were so many different types of children, and so many middle-class parents had put faith in their kids going to this not particularly wonderful school, that we were all mixed up, and you got used to talking high and talking low and just feeling comfortable. And I still have that, I think, but things have changed. My life is more rarefied. I meet a smaller group of people. I talk about books all the time, which is not a very healthy way of living, I think. So things have changed, and now I feel it's like my younger brother Ben, who's much more able to move easily. I'm more likely to feel awkward walking down a street now and seeing a gang of boys walking towards me. I might cross the street the way my father would. Things do change.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Zadie Smith's novel, On Beauty, is now out in paperback. She spoke with Terry Gross last year. Coming up, Little Children. Tom Perotta talks about his novel, now a film, starring Kate Winslet. This is Fresh Air. Tom Perotta's satirical novel Little Children is about a young woman named Sarah who is married, raising her child in an upper middle class suburb. Sarah can't understand how she wound up in the life she's living. But she believes she's found some meaning in her life when she meets Todd, a father at the playground, who seems to be as alienated as she is. They begin an affair and think they are falling in love. A film version of Little Children opened last week to critical acclaim. It was adapted for the screen by Todd Field, who also directed In the Bedroom. Perotta's other novels include The Wishbones and Election, which also was made into a movie. Here's Perotta reading from the beginning of Little Children.
The young mothers were telling each other how tired they were. This was one of their favorite topics, along with the eating, sleeping, and defecating habits of their offspring, the merits of certain local nursery schools, and the difficulty of sticking to an exercise routine. Smiling politely to mask a familiar feeling of desperation, Sarah reminded herself to think like an anthropologist. I'm a researcher studying the behavior of boring suburban women. I am not a boring suburban woman myself.
That's Tom Perotta reading from his novel Little Children. Let's also hear a scene from the new film adaptation. Kate Winslet stars as the ambivalent mother Sarah. In this scene, she flirts with the hunky stay-at-home dad, played by Patrick Wilson, at the playground.
Come here. Just... Come here. You see those women over there? Yeah, don't look. You know what they call you?
What?
The prom king.
Oh, God. Really?
Yeah, they mean it as a compliment. You're a big character in their fantasy lives.
Wow.
So one of them bet me $5 I couldn't get your phone number.
$5, huh?
Yeah.
But could we split it 50-50?
It could be arranged. It doesn't have to be your real number.
Oh, well, in that case, sure. You got a pen?
Great. No, I don't.
Well?
No, wait, just... wait. You know what? It'd really be funny. If you gave me a hug.
You think?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, come here.
Oh, my God.
Do you want to really freak him out?
That's a scene from the film adaptation of Tom Perrotta's novel, Little Children. Terry Gross spoke to Tom Perrotta in 2004 when his novel was published.
The main characters in this novel are kind of living the wrong life. Like Sarah, the main character who you were just reading about. This is not the life she wanted. She didn't plan on being a mother living in the suburbs. In college, she had been bisexual. She had an affair with a woman. She was immersed in critical gender studies. She worked at a rape crisis hotline. She was hoping to be a feminist film critic. I think a lot of people feel that they ended up in the wrong life. How did she get there?
Well, I think she got there the way a lot of people get where they end up. The years after college were particularly lonely for her. She was directionless. She tried graduate school, was very excited for a while, but then didn't like teaching very much, worked at Starbucks, had some affairs. And somehow there was a man at Starbucks, an older guy who was also a little bit lost, who found his way toward her. And, you know, they fell in love, so she thought, got married, and suddenly found herself in the exact... I mean, she didn't have a profession. He did. Basically, you know, there's a kind of economic determinism to it that's almost 19th century to her. I also think there's something about the generation, that's my generation, the people who went to college in the 80s and 90s, when feminism was still, I think, a really dynamic force in American culture. And you know, we, in our minds, imagined a whole different... set of social arrangements and family arrangements, and something happened, you know. I mean, when I was first a parent and at the playground, I was suddenly surprised to find myself often the only stay-at-home dad. You know, I wasn't a full-time stay-at-home dad, but I was doing about half-time childcare, and if I took my kids to the playground during the workday, I was usually the only man there. And I think that in the same way that I probably felt surprised by that and a little bit, like what had happened? What? Where was the world that we thought we were entering? I think someone like Sarah, who was, you know, really in the vanguard of this sort of thinking, probably felt it quite a bit more acutely than I did.
In the acknowledgments to your new novel, Little Children, you end it by saying, mainly, though, I'd like to thank Nina and Luke for letting me tag along at the playground. So I assume that Nina and Luke are your children, and that you spent a lot of time taking them to the playground and using that as inadvertent research for your novel. You have a really funny paragraph about what the few men who come to the playground with their children are like, what they look like, and how they behave. I'm going to ask you to read that paragraph for us from Little Children.
Okay. Most of the men who showed up at the playground during the workday were marginal types, middle-aged trolls with beards and pot bellies, studiously whimsical academics who insisted on going down the slide with their kids, pinch-hitting grandfathers providing emergency daycare, sheepish blue-collar guys who wouldn't meet anyone's eyes, the occasional cooler-than-thou hipster with a flexible schedule.
Were you the occasional cooler-than-thou hipster with a flexible schedule?
I was somewhere between the hipster with a flexible schedule and the studiously whimsical academic. But there was some part of me that was also a sheepish blue-collar guy who wouldn't meet anyone's eyes.
Oh, right. What was it like to be one of the few fathers regularly at the playground with your children?
Some women who were at the playground would deny this, but I was actually, I thought, made to feel somewhat unwelcome. There was just some sense of, you know, what is he doing here? And if you try to strike up a conversation, sometimes there was a little bit of reserve or coolness. But what did happen, and I think is something I tried to use in the novel, was that occasionally there would be a woman who, for some other reason, was not part of, you know, the sort of the core female society of the core mother group of the playground. And occasionally I would get into conversations with these women who, for whatever reasons, were also outsiders. And that's the dynamic, I think, between Todd and Sarah. They both feel somehow excluded from this core maternal clique at the playground. And it creates a kind of instant bond of intimacy between them.
There's a section in which Sarah goes shopping for a bathing suit, and she wants to get a bathing suit that makes her look really attractive, which was difficult. And I think most women agree that buying a good bathing suit is a real challenge, and it's something a lot of women are particularly self-conscious about. What kind of thinking did you do to try to write that scene from a woman's perspective?
For men, it's very interesting, you know, the point where you realize how you know nervous and anxious women get about these things, because of course, for most men, I think the idea of a woman in a bathing suit is you know, kind of a very exciting thing, and you know, the fact is women are probably much harder on themselves and their bodies than men are at a certain point. So I think that, again, it seems like a pretty pervasive thing. I mean, I read some catalogs, you know, and for instance, if you read, you know, the Land's End catalog, there's a very kind of, you know, the voice of the catalog is, you know, this is coverage, this is going to, you know, save you from certain embarrassing issues that will conceal the problem areas. I mean, it was really just right there in the forefront, and maybe, you know, what I was reading something that men don't normally pay attention to. You know, we're just supposed to look at the pictures. But it was, you know, right out in the front, you know. And I've certainly heard women, you know, talk about the bathing suit dilemma.
Do you want to read that paragraph?
Sure.
In this paragraph, Sarah is shopping with her young daughter, Lucy. And while she's, you know, trying to find a good bathing suit, she also has to keep track of where her daughter is.
That's right. And I should say that Sarah is hoping to go to the town pool and reconnect with Todd after their first intense flirtation. So she's given this a lot of thought. When she finally made her selections, she dragged Lucy into the fitting room and told her to stay put while she tried the suits on over her generously cut gray cotton panties, which kept poking out and spoiling the effect. Not that there was much to spoil. The first suit hugged her hips and waist perfectly, but looked about three sizes too big on top. The second fit nicely across her chest, but drooped off her ass like a tote bag. She thought the third suit looked okay. It was a black one-piece, daringly low-cut, with a series of oval cutouts traveling up the side. But when she left the fitting room to consult with the sales lady in front of the three-way mirror, the woman hesitated for a long time before answering. "I wouldn't," she said finally.
Yeah, I Sarah love that. You know, when you know, like when the sales lady who needs to sell you clothes thinks something looks bad, it really looks bad.
I know. Usually she would.
Thanks for reading that. Did you talk with your wife a lot about certain things, you know, before writing the book or while writing the book, just to get, you know, just again to get into a kind of female point of view of things?
I think when you live with somebody, you get their point of view.
Good point.
Kind of around the clock. I'm sure I had to ask her certain questions, and she'd be very happy to help me if I did. But I think it's more like, you know, a steady stream of information that I get from her and from, you know, other women friends.
Tom Perotta speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. His novel Little Children has just been made into a movie starring Kate Winslet. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein on the new movie The Queen. This is Fresh Air. Dame Helen Mirren has been highly praised for her performance as Queen Elizabeth in the new Stephen Frears movie, The Queen. The story is set at the time of Princess Diana's death, when the clash between the modern Diana and the monarchy became so apparent. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Here's the story at the heart of The Queen. A pretty and vulnerable young woman marries into a stuffy royal family and runs afoul of the chilly matriarch, who's the enemy of spontaneous emotion. It's the standard fairy tale princess template, except in this case, it's upside down and inside out. The princess is Diana, Princess Di, and word of her death comes near the beginning of the movie. The protagonist is actually Queen Elizabeth II, the icy monarch who tried to muzzle her, and who can't even bring herself to make a public statement of grief. Talk about a challenge for a filmmaker. The triumph of this sublime comedy of grand manners is that it gives us a way into this cold, lacquered, seemingly inhuman woman, to the point where we come to admire her. It helps that she's played by the marvelous Helen Mirren. Even as a monarch whose features barely bestir themselves, Dame Helen has one of the screen's most expressive faces. Shortly after Diana's death, Elizabeth watches the princess sniffle through an old TV interview, and it's uncanny how many emotions bleed through Mirren's regal mask. Distaste, horror, pity, regret, and perhaps something else. Envy. The director, Stephen Frears, and the screenwriter, Peter Morgan, prime you to scrutinize Mirren's face for signs of tension between the woman and the sovereign, and to marvel at the will it takes to keep up appearances when everyone on Earth thinks you're both scarily heartless and laughably out of touch. We all did, of course. We might have been divided on the subject of Diana's saintliness, but there was no disagreement about the royal's cluelessness. Listen to Mirren's Elizabeth firmly state her position on the matter of public mourning to the new Prime Minister, Tony Blair, played by Michael Sheen.
Coming down to London at the earliest opportunity. It would be a great comfort to your people. And would help them with their grief.
There. Grief. If you imagine I'm going to drop everything and come down to London before I attend to my grandchildren who've just lost their mother, then you're mistaken. I doubt there is anyone who knows the British people more than I do, Mr. Blair, nor who has greater faith in their wisdom and judgment. And it is my belief that they will any moment reject this mood, which is being stirred up by the press, in favor of a period of restrained grief and sober private mourning. That's the way we do things in this country, quietly, with dignity. It's what the rest of the world has always admired us for.
If The Queen is the story of Elizabeth and Diana's catastrophic antipathy, it's also a wry portrait of Liz and Tony's lucky symbiosis. At one point, Blair gazes heavenward and cries, "Will someone please save these people from themselves?" And that someone turns out to be Blair, the young and studiously informal Labour Party leader with the anti-monarchist wife. Strange bedfellows. Michael Sheen is more chipmunk-like than his real-life model, but it's hard to imagine a more generous portrait of the soon-to-be ex-PM. And as his spouse, Cherry, Helen McCrory makes a deliciously impudent foil. Frears is generous toward all his characters, except James Cromwell's Prince Philip, whose exclamations are unfailingly snobbish and dull. Even Charles, played by Alex Jennings, is more to be pitied than censured. He's always piping up about changing times and the need to be flexible, and you see him through his mother's eyes, not so much flexible as backboneless. Frears often makes films in which people chafe at being trapped in roles to which society has assigned them. In The Queen, he finds it in himself to revere a deeply unimaginative woman who accepts her assigned role and even fights to maintain it. The director invests her surroundings with genuine elegance instead of empty ostentation, and he shows us a different side of Elizabeth amid the mighty crags and rolling hills of her family's 40,000-acre Scottish estate. She sets out paper plates for a picnic. She tries to fix her own jeep, and she has a mystical, emotionally charged connection with a magnificent stag. That said, when she finally makes her grudging statement of grief, it's not a stand-up-and-cheer kind of climax. It is, however, a momentous one, because it marks for Queen Elizabeth II the passing of a more dignified, more orderly world. She knows that Diana, the princess of the modern celebrity culture, has won. But this cheeky yet reverent, not to mention absolutely delightful movie, makes you happy she surrendered with dignity.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from New Line Home Entertainment, presenting A Prairie Home Companion by director Robert Altman, a fictional account of the show's final broadcast, available on DVD October 10th. And from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Peabody Award-winning independent producer and host and curator of the This I Believe NPR series, Jay Allison. Also, Stephen Frears. His new film, The Queen, is a behind-the-scenes look at the interaction between the Queen of England and Prime Minister Blair during the tumultuous days following the death of Princess Diana. Join us for the next Fresh Air.